From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Cincinnati under curfew after police shoot dead another unarmed African American. This is the 15th black man to die at the hands of police since 1995. No whites were shot during the same period. We'll go to the streets of Cincinnati. We'll also speak with African American police officers in Washington and New Jersey and look at the call of New Jersey state senators for the impeachment of a state Supreme Court justice for lying about racial profiling. Also, the technology to be used for proposed oil drilling at the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is already endangering workers and the environment in Alaska. Whistleblowers tell the inside story. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Navy has notified the Puerto Rican government it plans to resume training exercises on Vieques soon, drawing criticism from the U.S. territory's governor and others who want the Navy to stop using the island for bombing practice. Puerto Rico Governor Sila Calderon called the Navy's announcement offensive and unacceptable. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld ordered the Navy to call off planned training last month, saying he was trying to find a permanent solution to the dispute over the exercise on Vieques, a small island off Puerto Rico's eastern coast with 9,400 residents. But critics say Rumsfeld had temporarily halted the bombing only to defuse the public's opposition. And yesterday, a march in Cochabamba, Bolivia, ended in violence as police beat demonstrators and arrested Oscar Oliveira, who is the winner of this year's Goldman Environmental Prize. Last year, under IMF urging, Bolivian water was privatized and sold to Bechtel Corporation and other foreign countries. Immediately, water bills doubled or tripled and sparked a series of widespread protests in February and April. Authorities fired tear gas and live bullets, killing one person. In April of last year, the government called a state of siege. We go now to Cochabamba, Bolivia, to speak to Catherine Lederber, coordinator of the Andean Information Network. Welcome to Democracy Now! What happened yesterday?
Amy, yesterday, Bolivian security forces, a combination of army and police, about 1,000 people, fired tear gas and beat demonstrators that were marching to La Paz to protest a series of issues, one of which was the forgiveness of the debt of the Cochabamba Water Company. Between 60 and 100 people were violently detained and forced on buses and driven back to Cochabamba. As we understand now, all the marchers have been released. Within this group was Oscar Oliveira, who was targeted by the security forces, and they had said that they had an arrest warrant for attempted murder connected with the beatings of some security officers. This appears to be untrue, and all marchers now have been released.
Can you explain what happened with undercover agents?
There were four undercover agents that were following the march. They had originally identified themselves as journalists and human rights workers. Marchers discovered them. They were heavily armed. They had a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf and cellular phones, and angry marchers began to beat them. Then they were turned over to human rights workers and taken to Cochabamba. This was one incident in a march that has been throughout the week peaceful, a march that is legal, and marchers have the right to march. This was one of the issues that set off the government violence.
And what about Bechtel? After the tremendous protests of last year, they ultimately, I understood, were forced out. Is that true? Is Bechtel still connected to the water supply?
Yes. Bechtel is one of the parent companies of International Water Limited. They had a huge issue, a huge interest in the company. Part of this has since been sold. They were forced out. Now the water company is back under public administration. Prices have gone back down, and the water supply has greatly increased in Cochabamba.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. I know that people in Cochabamba are preparing for anti-globalization protests. Is that right, next September?
Next September, there will be anti-globalization protests. We'll have to see. Right now, there's a very tense climate throughout the nation as all societal sectors are gathering together to protest the Banzer government. So we'll have to see what happens. There's a great possibility that there will be widespread national protests within the next several weeks as well.
Catherine Lederber, coordinator of the Andean Information Network in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Timothy McVeigh's execution for the Oklahoma City bombing will be shown on closed-circuit television to more than 200 survivors and victims' relatives who want to watch him draw his last breath. Attorney General John Ashcroft announced his decision yesterday, claiming it may help the group close the chapter on their lives. The U.S. government has not carried out an execution since 1963. In France, thousands of people living near a stockpile of World War I artillery shells and chemical weapons in northern France were ordered to leave their homes today after experts warned the site risked exploding. Among the weapons believed to be stored there are shells of mustard gas, the most lethal of all poisonous chemicals used during the First World War. Mustard gas causes horrific internal bleeding, blindness, and destroys victims' lungs in a slow death. And finally, some 1,000 French midwives marched to the prime minister's residence yesterday to demand higher wages and increased recognition of their status and qualifications. The midwives had declared the day a day without midwives and maternity clinics. The majority of babies in France are delivered by midwives, but the slogan was mostly symbolic because the strike affected mainly consultations, not births. The midwives began nationwide protests on March 20th after the government announced a monthly pay raise of $40 for novice midwives and $250 for their more experienced colleagues.
As a man is always talking about his inhumanity to man, but what is it trying to do to make it a better land? Oh, just read your paper, turn on your TV, you see folks demonstrating about equality. But maybe folks wouldn't have to suffer if there was more love for your brother. But these are trying times.
Trying times. Donny Hathaway here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. With police and riot gear out in the streets, the mayor of Cincinnati yesterday declared a state of emergency and imposed a citywide curfew amid the largest racial uprising in Cincinnati since the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. Activists shouted down Mayor Charles Lucan during the news conference, accusing him of bailing out of a meeting on their efforts to obtain a parade permit for a protest march. During the curfew, which lasted from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m., helmeted police patrolled the streets and a sheriff's helicopter hovered overhead. Police reported 42 arrests. The uprising was sparked by the police shooting of Timothy Thomas. He was 19, unarmed, and black. Officer Steve Roach gunned down Thomas as he fled from arrest for misdemeanor charges, most of which were traffic violations, including failure to wear a seatbelt. Police have killed 15 black men since 1995, 4 since last November. This week's uprising started in Over the Rhine, the neighborhood where Thomas was shot. Today, we go to a number of people in Cincinnati and around the country. We're going to begin with Victoria Strong. She is the Cincinnati representative of Black Cops Against Police Brutality. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you describe the streets over these last few days?
These last few days, I won't describe it as a riot, but more or less of a rebellion. Yes, the youth have been in the streets shouting down the police and directly addressing their issues, not only with city council, but with the police issue, and stating very clearly to them what the problem is and has been in the streets for a long time. They believe and feel that they've been patient now for over 5 years. We're talking about over 5 years and 16-some-odd deaths at the hands of police. So they feel like they've been very patient before they had to get to this point.
Daryl Hammond, you're one of the young people who's been on the streets of Cincinnati. Can you describe why you went out and what the streets have been like? Daryl, are you there? Well, we'll try to get Daryl in a minute. Victoria Strong, this number of shootings that you described, since 1995, 15 people. That's right. 15 African-American men.
That's right.
Since November 4, African-American men. White people killed by police during that time?
No, ma'am. Not at all. In fact, we've had several instances where the police have had run-ins with white males in the same age group who have either fled the scene or, in fact, have been faced with weapons, guns, knives, and things like that, and they've used other means to apprehend the suspect. They were able to live to tell the story the next day or have their day in court.
We're also joined on the telephone by Ayanna Love, who is a law clerk for Kenneth Lawson, the attorney representing Timothy Thomas's family, Timothy Thomas, the 19-year-old who was just killed by police officers. Ayanna Love, what is happening now legally, and how is Timothy's family?
Well, good morning, first of all. Obviously, they're in a period of grief and mourning right now for the loss of their son, the senseless loss of their son. They're preparing to bury him on Saturday. Legally, we are preparing to file a wrongful death suit against the officer in the city for murdering Timothy Thomas. I'd like to kind of piggyback on what Sister Victoria was saying about the 5 years that the city has basically been on notice, we believe, of a pattern and practice of Fourth Amendment violations that not just are about the killing of our black men, but just Fourth Amendment violations of unreasonable searches and seizures where the police have continuously harassed black men on the streets, taken them aside, searched them without any probable cause or reasonable suspicion. And what that has done is created this atmosphere that black men do not feel they are being heard. And the only way that they got the attention of city administration was to take to the streets.
Ayanna Love, we're going to break in for a second for Daryl Hammond because we lost him. His cell phone has very little juice, and we want to get him while he's still got his phone. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Daryl. Daryl's 25, one of the protesters in Cincinnati. Can you describe what the streets have been like and the police response?
And the police response.
Hey, you know, the last thing they're thinking about is milk.
Hello?
Hi, Daryl. Are you there?
Yeah. Yes, I'm here.
Can you describe what the streets are like right now and why you went out to protest in Cincinnati?
Well, right now, the streets are, it's clear. It's not how it normally is out here. I'm standing on Bernard Avenue, a place where, you know, a lot of teenagers hang. Police officers rode up the street with three state troopers trailing behind him. And, you know, everybody's still nervous. It's still tense. You can still feel it in the air. It's a lot of tension in the air still. Because we were at a meeting last night up on Redden Road at New Friendship Baptist Church, and Kwaisi Infomate was there. But talking the same thing they were talking when the first brother got killed in 95, you know, the unarmed brother got killed. They talking the same talk, so we really don't feel like it's going to be a difference. I don't feel like it's going to be a difference. I feel like they might kill me next week, you know? It's a lot of tension in the air, a whole lot of tension.
How do police deal with a young African-American man like you? Have you had run-ins with the police?
Yeah, I have many run-ins with them. The first thing they do is put their hand on their gun. That's the first thing they do. Tell you to get your hands out your pockets, and they unclip their gun. You know, they got their hand on it. They don't always pull it out, but they got their hand on it, you know. And that's tension right there. Well, I got a three-year-old son. I die tonight to see my son meet a ripe old age, so he can get him to make him be an old man. I'd die tonight for that if I have to. That's how I feel, and that's how a lot of brothers out here feel. We got kids, you know.
What are you demanding that the mayor do?
Resignations. That's the only thing that could help. Something's not right in there. I want to see some resignations. Something's not right with the upper brass. Something ain't right. It ain't us. You know, we out here doing what we always do, standing around. They ride past looking you up and down, got their doors cracked like they're ready to jump out on you for nothing. I got a group of brothers standing right here right now with me. Wait just a second. Hello?
Hi.
Hi, my name is Paul Greenwood.
Hi, Paul. Can you
how you doing?
Can you tell us why you've been out on the streets over the last few days?
I've been outside in the march trying to get some rights for my brothers. All the violence and all the turn up and all the looting, I don't condone all that, which it was at hand. But as far as the marching and trying to get our rights back and trying to get our freedom and our the way of life, I'm all for it.
What do you think needs to be done right now?
I think for real, the police need to get out here and try to tell us what's going down. Because for real, I feel after everything boiled down, they still going to get harder and harder on us. The court system and everything else, everything is going to be a little different. It's going to be harder on us. I don't think nothing's going to change. I think it's going to get worse.
What about the police response since, what was it, yesterday, the night before last night, when a police officer was shot, though he was wearing a bulletproof vest, so he's okay?
Oh, he's okay. And they're going to use that in perspective, too. They're going to use that against us as everything. You can be out here for domestic violence, anything. There's going to be, I mean, any kind of violence is going to be connected to the riot. Hmm.
Did you know Timothy Thomas?
The officer?
No,
shot.
The young man who was shot.
No, I don't know him, but I feel his family's pain.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know him personally.
Ayanna Love, you're working with the family, Timothy Thomas's family. Who was Timothy Thomas?
Timothy Thomas was a 19-year-old who had just recently moved from the south side of Chicago to his mother moved his family here to come to a better place, a safer place, to escape a bad environment in Chicago. And she was recently employed with Procter & Gamble, and she liked it. Timothy came here. He immediately received his GED within a year. He had just gotten a job and was to start Monday. And she was very proud of him. And he had a three-month-old son. He has a three-month-old son, Taiwan, who, you know, will never know his father now. I would like to say something about some things that could be done. We recently filed a class action lawsuit against the police for racial profiling. And I hate to use the term racial profiling as much as just Fourth Amendment violations. They keep violating the Constitution. And we're hoping to see some changes made through that process. We've entered into a collaborative process with the city. We're actually waiting for the city to go ahead and give the okay to enter into that and to have some real substantive changes to the police department, the disciplinary procedures that they go through, and the outlet we as citizens have to address complaints. Because right now we don't have an outlet to address Fourth Amendment violations that are continuously happening.
In terms of the lawsuit that you filed on behalf of, against the whole issue of racial profiling, you've interviewed hundreds of young people who have been beaten by police. What kind of recognition has that gotten in Cincinnati?
Well, I mean, you would think that after filing it less than a month ago, that the city administration and the police chief would talk to their troops and say, look, there's an issue out here and we need to deal with it. But apparently it didn't strike the chord that it should have, because 3 weeks later they've shot another black man. So, I mean,
I was just listening to Mayor Lucan of Cincinnati being interviewed, and he said they've been calling on the federal government to intervene in Cincinnati for years, and only yesterday they responded. What is that about?
Well, I mean, every time they shoot a black man, I think the Justice Department comes in. I think the FBI is investigated a few times. And they say, well, there's not enough evidence to show that there was an intent or to make any charges. So that they always come in. And that sounds real good when you say it, but with nothing gets done as a result, if there are no changes brought about, then it's just something that placates the people for a couple months. And then they continue the pattern and practice of pulling over black men, of, if you get pulled over for a speed ticket, that's fine, a speeding ticket, that's fine. But when you drag everyone out of the car, and then you search everybody, and then you check the trunk, and you hold them up for an hour so a police dog can come to smell for drugs, just based on the fact that they're black, you know, there is a problem in our city.
Ayanna Love, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Law clerk for the attorney representing Timothy Thomas's family. Also on the line with us, Daryl Hammond and other protesters in Cincinnati on the street now. Curfew was called from dawn until dusk. Victoria Strong with us, Cincinnati representative of Black Cops Against Police Brutality, and will be joined by the head of that organization as well. We'll be joined by DeLacy Davis from New Jersey, who will talk about the developments there around the acting governor of New Jersey, as well as a number of state senators calling on a state Supreme Justice to resign for covering up racial profiling. We've also been speaking, we'll speak with Ron Hampton, who is executive director of National Black Police Association in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Until we do something about it, it will never change.
It will never change.
Until we do something about
tell
it,
them.
It will never change.
It will never change.
Until we do something about it, it will never change.
It will never change.
Until we do something about
yeah.
It will never change.
Oh.
It will never change.
Tell them.
It will never change.
Better tell them.
It will never change.
It will never change.
Until we do something about it.
All that we got to do.
It will never change.
All that we got to work together.
It will never change. It will never change. It will never change.
Seriously.
Until we do something about it,
yes,
it will never change. It will never change.
We gotta do something
it
about
will never
it.
Change.
Yeah.
Until
yeah.
we do something about it.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. New Jersey Acting Governor Donald DeFrancesco leads a number of senators, including all 11 members of the State Senate Judiciary Committee, calling for the resignation or impeachment of a state Supreme Court justice for covering up being engaged in a pattern and practice of withholding and concealing information. They're calling for the impeachment of Justice Peter Verniro. In addition to the people we have on the phone, we're joined by Davis DeLacy. Davis DeLacy is the founder and president of Black Cops Against Police Brutality and a sergeant in the East Orange, New Jersey Police Department. Can you tell us about this case? And then we can fit it into the national context of what's going on in Cincinnati and around the country. The issue of this justice, the call for him to be impeached for lying to a Senate committee, routinely misleading lawmakers and withholding information about racial profiling by state police.
Sure, Amy. Good morning. A peace to the family. First of all, Mr. Verniro was very much aware of the 1996 Gloucester County Superior Court ruling in the Soto case, in which the judge then said that the state police of New Jersey were guilty of racial profiling, and all of the evidence was there. At that time, Mr. Verniro was the attorney general for the state of New Jersey. Mr. Verniro, on behalf of the state police, filed an appeal, which means that in 96 he had all of the data based upon the judge being the finder of fact and the state being guilty and him appealing. So clearly he had the information. He went on later on to say that it didn't crystallize for him until 1999. Unfortunately, that's unacceptable. That is clearly unacceptable. And now there's a call for his impeachment, because how can we trust that we're going to get justice at the Supreme Court level in the state of New Jersey when, in fact, when he went before the Senate again to be questioned 300 times, he either did not know, did not recall, or did not remember? Certainly for me as a law enforcement officer, that says that I'm not telling the truth.
Now, in April 1999, Verniro became the first attorney general to admit that state police have been targeting minorities, the admission coming a year or two after white troopers fired at four unarmed men of color, wounding three during a traffic stop on the New Jersey Turnpike. But the Senate Judiciary Committee, the state Senate Judiciary, contends that he had crucial information, as you're just describing, about racial profiling for years and offered intentionally vague answers during his Senate confirmation hearings in 1999. Those hearings for him to be confirmed as a state Supreme Court judge?
Yes. I think also what's most significant here and what's been left out of many of the media broadcasts is that in the early 90s, like 91 or 92, 13 black troopers filed a discrimination lawsuit against the New Jersey State Police. That lawsuit, to my understanding, still has not been settled. Those troopers, many of whom are still on the force, clearly articulated and outlined the practices of racial profiling, the discrimination that goes on still to this day in the barracks, the watermelons with African-American lips on them, on the lockers being tossed. In fact, one of the troopers that I've spoken with regularly over the last 3-4 years speaks about trying to arrest a white suspect out on the turnpike and white troopers riding up on the opposite side of the highway and refusing to assist him. And as he's rolling around the highway, they announce over their PA system, look at that black bear rolling on the ground. I mean, this was common practice and remains a part of the culture of the state police. So certainly, if in fact Mr. Venero did not want to read the facts that were presented to him in the 96 case, certainly could have looked at the lawsuit and what has been articulated by 13 black troopers who are still within the state police ranks and continue to argue that the practice is continuing.
Well, you're a police officer yourself. You're a sergeant. What do you see in your own department in East Orange?
In my own department, we have seen officers whom we have testified against. We have seen police brass whom we have testified against. And we have seen officers that we've actually marched and protested against. And as a result of those protests and changes, we now see a police department that is more responsive to the community. In fact, I command the Community Services Unit and manage approximately 40 programs that serve the community. The community can walk right into the police station now, walk into my office, and we walk them through the process of filing a complaint if, in fact, they believe that they have not received the service that they come to expect from law enforcement. So what we've seen is a department that the federal government has come in to investigate. There's certainly been some officers who work undercover who have been scrutinized, and we believe indictments are forthcoming based upon that. And now we have a department in many instances where officers are reluctant to be overly aggressive with the community because they know that we will respond on behalf of the community that we have sworn to protect and serve.
Ron Hampton is also with us, Executive Director of National Black Police Association in Washington, D.C. Your response to what you're watching on television in Cincinnati?
Well, I'm not surprised. And good morning, Amy.
It's good to
also
have you with us.
Peace, Ron.
I'm not surprised because I've been aware of the litany of killings that have taken place in Cincinnati since 1995, as well as the last four since November of last year. And I'm also aware that the police department has some crazy rules under civil service regulations and just the sort of unwillingness by the police chief, I think, and the fraternal order of police in that city to really sit down and negotiate with the city as well as the people of that community about the serious issues impacting the African-American community there. And there has always been tension around these issues. The 15 people that's been shot since 1995 are all black by white police officers, and there have been no killing of white people in that city in that period of time by the police. So there's some serious issues, and I just think that it's human nature that if you can't get results, if you can't get the attention of those people who are in power, who at least are in position to impact on certain issues, then people are going to feel frustrated. And at some point, the response that we see on television is going to be the response to the issues because they fail to deal with them in a proper and appropriate manner. And I was just amazed this morning listening to the, not really surprised, but again, that we're talking about this issue, and yet the president and CEO of the NAACP is in Cincinnati, Mr. Infume, and he happened to meet yesterday morning with the parents of the brother that was shot and killed by the police, and the mayor had never ever bothered to meet or talk with the parent of the son. And so when he met with her yesterday morning, he also had a meeting late on with the mayor, which he took her with him. And this was the first time since all of this has happened that they were able to sit down across the table from the mayor and talk about this issue. I mean, it's just absurd that the mayor would not have gone over there and said something to this mother. I mean, everybody, and under all circumstances, that's not the response that we ought to somehow or another have from our political leaders.
Hmm. Ronald Hampton, you're a strong advocate of community involvement, in policing. What does that mean?
Say that again?
You're a strong advocate of community involvement in policing. What does that mean?
Well, I think it means some of the things that DeLacy talked about. I think it means that communities need to be more involved in the process. We citizens give the power to police the community, also to protect the community, and yet they're not intricately involved in that process. We have coined a few community-friendly phrases like community policing, and in some places those things work. But in most communities where whites live, that works all of the time, the relationship between the police and the community. What we want to see is that type of relationship all the time in the people of color community, not a after-the-fact relationship. When there's a problem, then you come to me and want my help to turn in the people who live in my community. But every other time, you don't have anything to do with me, and the only relationship I have with you is the one that involves a great deal of tension and stress as a result of your inconsiderate behavior in my community. So it calls for a continuum of a relationship. It calls for involvement, participation in the process by which you develop strategies to work in my community, because I don't know anybody who lives in a community that doesn't want a crime and violence in their community. That's every single community, regardless of what city, what country, what state we live in. So we haven't had that kind of relationship, and that documentation goes all the way back to the Kerner Commission. They talked about the lack of relationship, and every report that I've ever read since then talks about the lack of relationship, and the rise that they're having in Cincinnati this week is a result of the lack of a relationship between the Cincinnati Police Department, the politicians there, and the communities of color.
Ron,
so we have never realized it.
Ron Hampton, we're also joined by Allison Collins, who's with Human Rights Watch, and she did a report several years ago looking at police brutality and accountability systems in 14 cities, Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, Detroit, Minneapolis, New York, Philadelphia, San Francisco, D.C., and a number of other places, Portland, Oregon as well. What did you find, Allison?
Well, a lot of similar situations to what you're now seeing in Cincinnati, a lot of unchecked abuses, disciplinary systems that aren't working, civilian review that is often failing the citizens that are supposed to be helping. We looked at citizen review in those cities, internal affairs units, civil lawsuits that cost cities millions of dollars yet have no effect on police practices or policies, and the very poor record of criminal prosecution of officers in those cities, whether it's locally or federally, officers get away with it more often than not.
What about, they have different names around the country, civilian complaint review boards. How effective are they?
Well, it's a mixed bag. When I read more about what happened in Cincinnati, it's a perfect example of a very flawed system. They made recommendations that were ignored on a number of previous shootings. They made policy recommendations. They made findings in individual cases that were ignored. They also can't come into looking at cases until criminal prosecutions are completed. And then the city manager in Cincinnati criticizes the review board for taking too long. Well, they can't go any quicker. So it's pretty powerless from what I can tell. They really do need to beef it up. And I think these kinds of situations would be avoided if they had some strong citizen review that citizens had some faith in. That is not happening in Cincinnati. Overall, nationally, it's a mixed bag. I think a lot of review boards are operating in a decent way. I think many are underfunded and underutilized, and in too many cases under attack by police unions and police departments that fail to cooperate with them or in some cases even sue them for existing. So you have some successes and you have some failures, but I think it's the idea is right, and it's one component to better accountability.
What about the issue of subpoena power? Often these groups, the boards like these, a civilian that supposedly have oversight, can basically just gather statistics.
Yeah, a lot of them are pretty powerless. They're looking at cases when the cases are over and reviewing. I mean, sometimes this can work. This actually works in a few cities where they have strong auditing powers, and they review cases. They look at internal affairs files for each excessive force or other type of complaint. They find where there are shortcomings in the investigation, where they didn't interview witnesses, where the story by the officer is clearly false, those sorts of cases. They give it back to the chief or the commissioner, suggest that there be another investigation, and there's actually action. But in many cases, they're looking at it after the fact. They're always going to be late. And many don't even take initial complaints from citizens, so citizens are still having those initial barriers where they have to go to the police in order to file a complaint against the police. And we've seen often how police sergeants and others at desks create obstacles to accepting those complaints. But when you say collect statistics, some might, but very few review boards actually put out useful reports. One thing that they can do is at least provide information to citizens that police departments never provide. And some do that. Some don't even do that much. So there is a lot of room for improvement, but it's a positive step to have some kind of citizen involvement when residents have lost all faith in internal affairs divisions or others to hold officers accountable and discipline them properly.
I wanted to go now to Felicia Davis, who is a board administrator of the Civilian Review Board in Syracuse, New York, also an African-American attorney. How does your citizen review board work? Do you think it has worked at all?
I would say it has worked. I'd say you would have to measure what you consider to be successes based on the particular aims of the ordinance itself in any particular area, whether it be complaint intake, actual processing, or the fact that the board is able to hold public hearings into complaints.
Has the police union blocked police from ever testifying before your board?
Yes, we have had a series of litigational efforts put forth by the Police Benevolent Association here in Syracuse that actually started within 2 or 3 months of the board's inception and operation.
What about recommendations? Do police ever adopt your recommendations?
As a general rule, no, I cannot say that there has been adoption of the board's recommendations, whether on particular specific complainants' cases, or the board also has the ability to make comment on public policy public policy and process of the police department. So as a general rule, no. There may be one or two instances in 7 years where that's happened, but as a general rule, no.
Do you have subpoena power?
Have subpoena power. However, there is a stay on the board's ability to use its subpoena power to compel or officers' attendance at its public hearings, and that injunction that was granted in January of 1998 has not yet been lifted.
Have you ever been successful in bringing a police officer to justice?
Well, to me, the term justice is relative. Have we ever had a police officer testify under subpoena? Yes, that happened in 1995. And an interesting part of what happened is this officer was subpoenaed by the board, came and testified as a part of a complainant's case. He was a witness officer. And as a result, and he brought it to a lawsuit, actually, there were issues concerning his discharge after that.
I wanted to take this story back to Cincinnati now with Ayanna Love, the law clerk with the attorney representing Timothy Thomas's family, and Victoria Strong, the Cincinnati representative of Black Cops Against Police Brutality. Ayanna Love, is there any kind of civilian complaint review board in Cincinnati?
We do have a citizens review panel, police review panel, like they were mentioning with all the problems, they don't have subpoena power. They basically see a case maybe a year to 2 years after it's finally gone through all the other reviews. So it's powerless right now. We, however, do have a separate entity, the Office of Municipal Investigation, which is supposed to be completely separate from the police. And it could be a very powerful tool for African Americans and others. They investigate police along with other city agencies. But what happens, that we found to happen, is that when someone lodges a complaint against an officer and it goes through the Office of Municipal Investigation, they may then come out with a recommendation for disciplinary procedures against that officer, and they send it to our city manager, who then signs off on the recommendations, but then he then sends it down to the police chief, who, if they recommended disciplinary action, he then totally reviews the case again. And of course, you know, once you send it to the police for review, they change everything, and then that officer never gets disciplinary action. So we see a huge problem with the head of the city manager, saying, yes, the police need a discipline in this circumstance, but then he sends it down to the police chief, who says, you know, we don't really take what you say as authority, and we're going to review it again and change it. So there is no power for the citizens right now.
Victoria Strong, was Officer Steve Roach known on the streets, the man who gunned down Timothy Thomas?
Some of the brothers that we have been talking to, they were familiar with him and said and pointed him out as one of the ones who often come through and have brutalized them both verbally and physically. And they say that this is a regular occurrence that goes on in the community. A lot of times they're handcuffed, beat up. They showed scars where heads were hit up against the wall. And even when we were down there cleaning up the area and trying to set up a little memorial from where the brother was shot and killed, the police, even the very next day, hours after it happened, were just driving through the community and still taunting the citizens. Until one of the ministers here, Reverend Damon Lynch, had to step to him and ask him, would you please leave and go away so we could talk to our people? This is how arrogant the police situation here is in the city. And I must give Cincinnati one thumb up, because they have hid the filth and stench of this city for a long time. We're talking about years of gentrification. People who feel disenfranchised, invisible. They've never listened to any of the activists in the city. And ever since Roger Owensby was choked to death by a police officer, I believe in November, we have had a group of citizens who have been down at city council every Wednesday since that has happened to remind them and to get them back on track so that this does not fall by the wayside. They knew and we knew it was going to happen again. This city just did not listen.
A couple years ago, I spent some time in the Over the Rhine community. According to the Over the Rhine Community Center, the area where Timothy Thomas was killed, it's Cincinnati's poorest neighborhood. 95% of the 12,000 inhabitants live below the poverty line. 5,000 of 7,500 apartment units are below code or abandoned. 95% of the housing is owned by absentee landlords. Yet you've got a city that has some of the wealthiest corporations, like, for example, Chiquita and Procter & Gamble. How do they fit in?
They come here because, again, you have this facade that this city is a clean and conservative city. Again, they've managed to keep a lot of that, the stench that goes on in this city, they've managed to keep it under control. That's why you had Ms. Leisure feel that this was a safe city to move to. And it wasn't. It was never a safe city to move to. This city has sprawl all over the place. And in fact, the last few census numbers that have showed that there have been flight out of the city with both black and white residents.
You've offered to go out and pull kids off the streets if the police pull out of the streets as well?
Yes, we have. We asked them, I believe it was Tuesday night, if we would get the police to pull back, we would be willing to go in and get them off the streets. See, we've been out here with them for quite some time, and we were told absolutely not, no deal. And so you had this thing explode into 3 or 4 days now, and I think the Wednesday it exploded into various communities. It was generally downtown in the area, near the area where the young man was killed, but then it spread out throughout the city. And then there started, you know, gun battles back and forth. We began to hear more gunfire.
Ayanna Love, when is the funeral for Timothy Thomas expected?
That is scheduled for Saturday.
Uh-huh. And what is planned for that?
I believe there's going to be, I think the family is trying to keep a lot of it private. I know that Saturday there will be services at New Prospect, Reverend Damon Lynch's church, and I believe there will be a burial following, maybe the next day. I'm not, you know, privy to give out all that information with the specifics and times and everything.
And Victoria Strong, the streets, what do you expect? Is the curfew going to remain?
Well, from what we're getting, they are talking about this curfew remaining throughout the weekend. My concern is we have a number of brothers who are, again, this is spring break for them. The weather here has been, it's been hot. Just last night it got a little cooler. But we have a lot of brothers here in the city that are still mad. They still feel like they haven't given them answers. And some of them are still vowing that they will hit the streets again and ignore the curfew if they have to.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. An interesting roundtable discussion. Victoria Strong, Black Cops Against Police Brutality. The Cincinnati representative, the head of that group, is DeLacy Davis. We spoke to in New Jersey about their own situation in New Jersey and the call for a state Supreme Court justice to be impeached because he covered up racial profiling for years as attorney general. Ayanna Love, law clerk for Kenneth Larson, who is the attorney representing Timothy Thomas's family. Again, you heard the funeral will be on Saturday. Ellison Collins of Human Rights Watch that did the report on the police brutality and accountability systems in 14 cities. Felicia Davis, head of the Civilian Complaint Review Board in Syracuse, New York, and Ron Hampton, who is the head of the police Black Police Officers Association in Washington, D.C. I want to thank you all for being with us and all the contact information you can get on our websites. You can also listen to the program again if you didn't get to hear it all at webactive.com. That's www.webactive.com. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, an expose on the technology that could be used in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. A whistleblower speaks out. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. The technology used to drill oil in the Arctic region can be fatal to workers and devastating to the environment. This from a group of whistleblowers who work the Prudhoe Bay site that is a model for proposed development of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. In information released today, the whistleblowers charge that cost-cutting design, deferred maintenance, leaky and stuck valves, and understaffing make the Arctic oil wells a disaster waiting to happen. Already, accidents at Prudhoe Bay have resulted in hundreds of contaminating spills, a major fire, and the deaths of several workers. Despite assurances by the Bush administration that the technology is safe, accidents plague the oil industry. Yesterday in Brazil, an offshore blowout forced the evacuation of workers and dumped thousands of gallons of crude oil into the sea. Just 3 weeks before, a fire and explosion at another Brazilian facility killed 11 workers and sank the world's biggest floating oil rig. Also yesterday, an oil rig in New Mexico blew and burst into flames, injuring 3 workers, one critically. Drilling conditions in the Arctic are far more difficult. At Prudhoe Bay, workers maintain and inspect open-air well facilities throughout the severe winters. The whistleblowers charge that if there were a severe accident, they might not know about it for days, and even then, they might be unable to reach machinery that's buried in the snow and blasted by high winds. If President Bush and his Interior Secretary, Gail Norton, get their way, similar technology will be used to open up the pristine Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. We're joined right now by Chuck Hamill, who is a former oil industry insider, and Jim Carlton, who is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who has a piece on the front page of the paper today called "An Alaskan Wilderness, Friendlier Technology Gets a Cold Reception. BP Amoco Workers Question Safety of Drilling Systems Bush Touts for Refuge." Can you describe what happened when the Interior Secretary, Gail Norton, went to the Arctic, and also Mary Matlin's role, spokesperson for Dick Cheney?
Right, Amy. Good morning. This is Jim Carlton. What happened, and had not been reported before, when Gail Norton went up to the North Slope on her much-publicized tour at the end of March, just a few days before that, state inspectors had made a very startling discovery.
in doing routine testing of some of the safety valves at one particular drilling platform called GPAD, they found that 30% of the emergency safety valves failed to close. It was 9 out of 30 of the valves they tested. They called that an extremely high rate. Over 10% is considered a very worrisome rate. And BP itself calls that an anomalous rate that they're investigating now.
BP being British Petroleum.
British Petroleum.
And what do these valves do?
These are the valves. It's called a surface safety valve, SSV. And this is the valve which is operated remotely. There are some other valves in the vicinity, and it connects the well to basically above ground, processing equipment. And the others, there's two other valves, but they can only be controlled manually. This one is controlled remotely. And in the Alaskan Arctic, this is pretty critical because, with the elements, in the event of a blizzard, which happens a lot up there, the workers can't always get out quickly to close valves by hand.
Chuck Hamill is also with us, former oil industry insider. The BP workers came to you. Why and what are their major concerns?
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
Well, I think that Jim Carlton captured their concerns very, very well. And I think if you if folks go to that his article, and also these in helping these gentlemen, and they're not whistleblowers, and I'll explain that in a minute, we've formed a website called ANWR, ANWR News, NEWS, that explains their dilemma. And you have to understand that the Arctic wilderness will no longer be in the dark, as it has been over decades. The people of the United States, the public, will now be able to know what's really happening up there. And this website was my idea to help them when they came to me. And they came to me months ago, and I couldn't help. I just had to live. I've been in deep trouble for doing this before with Alaska concerned employees in the oil field. But there's so many in this case that you can't call them whistleblowers. A whistleblower is one or two people. They wrote a letter to Sir John Brown of British Petroleum in 1999, January, and said, we're gonna have some disaster here, and it's your facilities. And for us, it's our lives that we're dealing with. And on the site, we've got the new letter that was released yesterday to Sir John Brown. But everyone who goes to Alaska, every reporter in America, and including, look at the congressional folks, and the Secretary of Interior, they are all in the exact same dog and pony show, if I could call it that. No one is allowed in those facilities. They're off limits to everyone. It's about 60 miles by 10 miles wide or whatever. And everyone has the exact same story throughout the United States and in the press about how great it is. And there's all this new technology, which they've adopted new technology that is faulty and dangerous and improbable for an oil field.
Can let me ask the Wall Street Journal reporter, Jim Carlton, if you can just give us a little geographical lesson here on Prudhoe Bay and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where they stand in relation to each other.
Yes, Amy. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge takes up about 19 million acres. It's in the extreme northeastern corner of Alaska. The area that would be drilled, that the president proposes to be drilled, is a 1.5 million acre sliver of the of that refuge along the coastal plain. Now, if you in your mind's eye look to your west, about 50 to 60 miles due west of that is Prudhoe Bay, and Prudhoe Bay is a massive industrial complex sprawling over about 1,000 square miles. It's roughly the size of Rhode Island. There's drilling platforms, there's pipes, there's roads, there's sumps, there's the usual thing you'd find in an oil field. Now, what the administration touts as beneficial for ANWR would be, they say, the state of the art of the of the industry now, in which these drilling platforms are much smaller than the ones that that have been used at Prudhoe Bay. However, the implication of what these workers are saying, who went through Chuck Hamill, and airing their concerns, is that the same techniques would be used at ANWR as are used at Prudhoe, in that there's an intricate network of emergency safety valves that are needed to keep oil from spewing all over the pristine Alaskan tundra.
What is the Bush administration saying about this?
I interviewed Mary Madeline, who, of course, is Vice President Cheney's representative on the National Energy Task Force. And she actually went to Prudhoe Bay with Gail Norton a few weeks ago. And she emphasized that the administration would demand, I mean, not request, but would demand that that strict environmental safeguards would be required before there's any exploration in the sensitive, coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We spoke to the a spokesman for the White House who said that the administration reiterates that they believe that the technology exists to have a small footprint, as it were, very benign presence on the coastal plain. And in fact, the technology is impressive in that when you compare it to decades ago when we had, fields of, unsightly oil rigs in places like West Texas, in Alaska, now these drilling platforms are as small as 10 acres, and they can, drill out horizontally and diagonally across, many miles to connect as many as 50 wells.
You have two BP employees saying a major spill or fire at one of our centers will exit the piping at high pressure, leave a half-mile-wide oil slick on the white snow all the way to ANWR. That's the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Chuck Hamill, are you reassured by the White House's response?
I can't be, because why the president has been saying all along that they're doing it correctly up there now and they're protecting the environment. I think the president of the United States has been duped by the industry, because there's no way President Bush would ever make the pronouncements he's been making if he goes to our website today. I think he's going to be pretty upset, and I feel bad. I've sent messages to the White House. I've warned the governor that his staff was allowing during test results for these valves, were allowing them to, because they wouldn't shut, they wouldn't close. It's dangerous for the facility and the people. That they allow them to heat up the valves and then re-grease them and then run the test again over a day's time. Can you imagine gas lines coming into your home and the gas company, if some of their valves out in the street don't work too good and they don't want to spend money to do preventive maintenance, that when they don't close remotely, they're going to send a gas crew there and open up the heat of the valve and
would BP, would British Petroleum be one of those that would drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge if it's opened?
Well, they're pretty much on the list. Yes, of course.
Well, it's interesting that
they have to bid for it.
While President Bush acknowledges the uphill fight he faces on Capitol Hill, he has included presumed revenues from leases in the refuge in his budget.
That's correct, but I don't think he'll want to do that if he knows what's really happening, which he can now. And I am asking you to please don't use the word whistleblowers anymore, because there's 77 of these operators of that facility out of one shift of about 110, wrote that letter in 1999 to the chairman owner of BP and told them that this is dangerous and it's gotten worse. And there's a new letter.
Chuck Hamill and Jim Carlton, I want to thank you for being with us. Wall Street Journal reporter and Chuck Hamill, former oil industry insider. That website, www.anwrnews.com. That's anwrnews.com. That does it for the program. If you'd like to email us, mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Look forward to seeing people at the Socialist Scholars Conference this weekend in downtown Manhattan at 7 East 7th Street, Hewitt Auditorium, Saturday from 1:30 on, talking about the independent media. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan's our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBA, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!